This is Black Wall Street Chronicles, and we're back at it again. Today, we're going to talk about Joan Ruth Bader Ginsburg. She was the Supreme Court Justice Associate that just died. She was a person who was an advocate for feminism and LGBTQ issues. We're going to have a quick moment of silence before we get started. All right, let's get to it. So there's some controversy in her death. First, we're going to talk about her life and all she accomplished. We're going to have the controversy around her death about how President Trump and the Republican Party is trying to force a Supreme Court justice to be installed. And we're also going to talk about how even though she did a lot for LGBTQ and feminism, we're going to talk about how she was against black athletes protesting against police brutality. So before we get started, it's time for some announcements. I currently reached affiliate in my Twitch account. If you want to follow me on my Twitch is... Hold on, let me give you the information. My Twitch channel is JeffGamer55Ryer, which is JeffGamerFFRYER. Again, my Twitch tag is JeffGamer55Ryer. JeffGamer55Ryer. If you are interested in looking at people playing video games and chatting about video games, feel free to contact me. Also, my Twitter account is... give me a moment. My Twitter is... Jeffrey Frazier at Ghetto Clavicade. That's GhettoClavacade. You can just look me up on Jeffrey Frazier. You'll just find my name on there. If you want to, you can follow me on my Twitter. My YouTube account is Pain308TV. If you want to look at my YouTube and you want to look at live stream of my podcast videos, you can do so. Again, my YouTube account is Pain308TV. My Instagram is BlackKage840. Again, my Instagram is BlackKage840. You should be able to see me. You can see live stream of my podcast also. Okay, so let's get started. Joan Ruth Bader was born on March 15, 1933 at Beth Moses Hospital in Brooklyn, New York City. She was the second daughter of Celia and Nathan Bader, who lived in the Flatbush neighborhood. Her father was a Jewish immigrant from Odessa, Ukraine, at the time part of the Russian Empire, and her mother was born in New York to parents who came from Kafko, Poland. The Bader's elder daughter, Marilyn, died of meningitis at age 6 when Ruth was 14 months old. The family called Joan Ruth Kiki, a nickname Marilyn had given her for being a Kiki baby. When Kiki started school, Celia discovered that her daughter's class had several other girls named Joan, so Celia suggested the teacher call her daughter Ruth to avoid confusion. Although not devout, the Bader family belonged to Eastward Midward Jewish Center, a conservative synagogue where Ruth learned the tenets of Jewish faith and gained familiarity with the Hebrew language. Starting as a camper from age of 4, Ruth attended Camp Chinawa, a Jewish summer program in Lake Buffalo near Minerva, New York, where she was later a camp counselor until the age of 18. Selena took an active role in her daughter's education, often taking her to the library. Celia had been a good student in her youth, graduating from high school at age 15, and she could not be further from her own education because her family instead chose to send her brother to college. Celia wanted her daughter to get more education, which she thought would allow Ruth to become a high school history teacher. Ruth attended James Madison High School, whose law program later dedicated a courtroom in her honor. Celia struggled with cancer through Ruth's high school years and died the day before Ruth's high school graduation. Bader attended Cornell University in Ithaca, New York, and was a member of Alpha Epsilon Phi. While in Cornell, she met Martin D. Ginsburg at age 17. She graduated Cornell with a Bachelor's of Arts degree in government June 23, 1954. She was a member of Phi Beta Kappa and the highest ranking female student in her graduating class. Bader married Ginsburg a month after her graduation from Cornell. She and Martin moved to Fort Sill, Oklahoma, where he was stationed as a Reserve Officers Training Corps officer in the U.S. Army Reserve after his call up to active duty. At 21, she worked for the Social Security Administration office in Oklahoma, where she was demoted after becoming pregnant with her first child. She gave birth to a daughter in 1955. In the fall of 1956, Ginsburg enrolled at Harvard Law School, where she was the only non-woman in a class of about 500 men. The dean of Harvard Law reported invited all the female law students to dinner in his family home and asked the female law students, including Ginsburg, "Why are you at Harvard Law School taking the place of a man?" When her husband took a job in New York City, Ginsburg transferred to Columbia Law School and became the first woman on two major law reviews, the Harvard Law Review and the Columbia Law Review. In 1959, she earned her law degree at Columbia in time for first in her class. At the start of her legal career, Ginsburg announced difficulty in finding employment. In 1960, the Supreme Court Justice Felix Frankfurter rejected Ginsburg for the clerkship position due to her gender. She was rejected despite a strong recommendation from Albert Martin Sachs, who was a professor at the Dean of Harvard Law School. Columbia Law Professor Jared Gunter also pushed for Judge Edward L. Palmieri of the U.S. District Court of the Southern District of New York to hire Ginsburg as a law clerk, threatening to never recommend another Columbia student to Palmieri if he did not give Ginsburg the opportunity and guarantee to provide the judge with a placement clerk should Ginsburg not succeed. Later that year, Ginsburg began her clerkship for Judge Palmieri, and she held the position for 2 years. Academia. From 1961 to 1963, Ginsburg was a research associate and an associate director of Columbia Law School Project on International Procedure. She will learn Swedish to co-author a book with Andreas Bruzarius on civil procedure in Sweden. Ginsburg conducted extensive research on a book on Lund University in Sweden. Ginsburg's time in Sweden and associated with the Jewish Bruzarius family, a jurist, also influenced her on gender equality. She inspired her when she observed changes in Sweden, where women were 20 to 25% of all law students. One of the judges who Ginsburg observed was for her research was 8 months pregnant and still working. Bruzarius' daughter, Norwegian Supreme Court and President of Norwegian Association for Women's Rights, and Kara and Bruzarius, herself a law student when Ginsburg worked with her father, and said, "By getting close to my family, Ruth realized that no one could live completely differently in that way, that women could have a different lifestyle and legal position than when they had in the United States." Ginsburg's first position as a professor at Rutgers Law School in 1963. The appointment was not without its drawbacks. Ginsburg was informed she would be paid less than her male colleagues because she had a husband with a well-paid job. At the time Ginsburg entered academia, she was one of the few then 20 female law professors in the United States. She was a professor of law, mainly civil procedure, at Rutgers from 1963 to 1972, receiving tenure from the law school in 1969. In 1970, she co-founded the Women's Rights Law Reporter, the first law journal in the U.S. to focus completely exclusive on women's lives. From 1972 to 1980, she taught at Columbia Law School, where she became the first tenured woman and co-authored the first law school casebook on sex discrimination. She also spent a year as a fellow for the Center of Advanced Study in Behavioral Sciences for Stanford University from 1977 to 1978. In 1972, Ginsburg co-founded the Women's Rights Project at American Civil Liberties Union, and in 1973 she became the project's general counsel. The Women's Rights Project and related ACLU projects participated in more than 30 gender discrimination cases by 1974. As the director of ACLU's Women's Rights Project, she argued 6 gender discrimination cases before the Supreme Court between 1973 and 1976, winning 5. Rather than asking the court to end all gender discrimination at once, Ginsburg charted a strategic course, taking aim at specifically discriminatory status and building on each successive victory. She chose plaintiffs carefully, at times speaking male plaintiffs to demonstrate that gender discrimination was harmful to both men and women. The laws Ginsburg targeted include those that was on the surface appeal beneficial to women, being in fact reinforced the notion that women needed to be dependent on men. Her strategic advocacy extended to word choice, favoring the use of gender instead of sex. After the secretary suggested the word sex was stirred as a distraction to judges, she attained a reputation as a skilled oral activist, and her work led directly to the end of gender discrimination in many areas of the law. Ginsburg volunteered to write the brief for Reed v. Reed, and the Supreme Court extended the protections of the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment to women. In 1972, she argued before the 10th Circuit in Moyse v. Commissioner on behalf of a man who has been denied a caregiver deduction because of his gender. As amicus, she argued for Taylor v. Richardson, where she challenged a statute making it more difficult for a female service member to claim an increased housing allowance for her husband than for a male service member seeking the same allowance for his wife. Women argued that the statute treated women as inferior, and the Supreme Court ruled 8-1 in Fraternal's favor. The court again ruled in Ginsburg's favor in Winsburg v. Winston held, where Ginsburg represented a widow denied survivor benefits under Social Security, which permitted widows, not widowers, to collect special benefits while caring for minor children. She argued that the statute discriminated against male survivors or workers by denying them the same protection as their female counterparts. In the same year that Roe v. Wade was decided, Ginsburg filed with the first federal case to challenge involuntary sterilization, suing members of the Eugenics Board of North Carolina on the behalf of Nile Roos Cock, a mother who has been conversely sterilized under North Carolina's Sterilize a Person Mentally Defective program on penalty of her family losing welfare benefits. During a 2009 interview with Emily Bazelet of New York Times, Ginsburg stated that, "I had thought that the time Roe was decided, there was concern about population growth and partially growth in populations that we don't want to have too many of." Barraza conducted a follow-up interview with Ginsburg in 2012 in a joint appearance at Yale University, where Ginsburg claimed her 2009 quote was vastly misinterpreted in clarifying her stance. Ginsburg filed an amicus brief and sat on a counsel for argument for Craig v. Bowen, which challenged the Oklahoma statute on the set different minimum drinking ages of men and women. For the first time, the court imposed what is known as the intermediate scrutiny, a law discriminates based on gender, a heightened standard of constitutional review. The last case as an attorney before the Supreme Court in 1978, Duren v. Missouri, which challenged the validity of voluntary jury duty for women on the ground that participation in jury duty was a citizen's vital government service and therefore should not be optional for women. At the end of Ginsburg's oral argument, the Associate Justice William Reckless asked Ginsburg, "You won't settle for putting Susie B. Anthony on a new dollar then?" Ginsburg said it as she considered responding, We won't settle for tokens, but instead opted not to answer the question. League of Scholars advocate credits Ginsler's body of work, making significant legal advances for women under the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution. Taken together, Ginsburg's legal victories discouraged legislators from treating women differently under the law. She continued to work on ACU's Women's Rights Project until appointment to the federal bench in 1980. Lady colleague Anton Scalia praised Ginsburg's skills as an advocate. She became the leading and very successful litigator on behalf of women's rights. Dugger Marshall of the Kaskin piece, so to speak, was a comparison that had been made by former Solicitor General Erwin Griswold, who was once a former professor and dean at Harvard Law School, in a speech given in 1985. In the light of mounting backlog in the federal judiciary, Congress passed the Omnibus Judgeship Act of 1978, increasing the number of federal judges by 117 in district courts and another 35 to be added to the circuit courts. The law placed an emphasis on ensuring that the judges included women and minority groups, a matter that is important to President Jimmy Carter, who has been elected 2 years before. The bill also required that nomination process consider the character and experience of the candidates. Ginsburg was considering a change in career as soon as Carter was elected. She was interviewed the Department of Justice to become Solicitor General, the position she most desired, but knew that she, an African-American candidate who was interviewed the same day, had little chance of being appointed by Attorney General Griffin Bell. At the time, Ginsburg, fellow of Stanford University, where she was working on a written account of the work in litigation and advocacy for equal rights. Her husband was a visiting professor at Stanford Law School and was ready to leave his firm. Well, Gosha and Mangs for a 10-year position, he was at the same time working hard to promote a possible judgment for his wife. In January 1979, she filed out the questionnaire for possible nominees to the Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit and another for the District of Columbia Circuit. Ginsburg was nominated by President Carter on April 14, 1980. To a seat on District Circuit Appeals. Court was vacated by Judge Harold Lufendahl upon his death. She was not confirmed by the United States Senate on June 18, 1980, and received commission later that day. During her job as a judge on the D.C. Circuit, Ginsburg often found consensus with her colleagues, including conservatives Robert H. Bork and Anton Scalia. Her time at the court earned her a reputation as a cautious jurist and moderate. Her service ended on August 9, 1993, due to an elevation to the United States Supreme Court, and she was replaced by Judge David S. Tetel. President Bill Clinton nominated Ginsburg as an Associate Justice of the Supreme Court on June 22, 1993. To fill the seat vacant by retired Justice Byron Wright, she was recommended to Clinton by then U.S. Attorney General Janet Reno, after a suggestion by Utah Republican Senator Orrin Hatch. At the time of her nomination, Ginsburg was viewed as a moderate and was a contentious builder in the time of appeals court. Clinton was reportedly looking to increase the court's diversity, which Ginsburg did not at the first Jewish justice since the 1969 resignation of Justice Ab Fortos. She was the second female and the first Jewish female justice of the Supreme Court. She eventually became the longest-serving Jewish justice. The American Bar Association Standing Committee on the Federal Judiciary rated Ginsburg as well qualified as the highest possible rating for a prospective judge. During a testimony before the United States Committee on the Judiciary as part of the confirmation hearings, Ginsburg refused to answer questions about her view on constitutionality of some issues such as the death penalty, as it was an issue she may have to vote on if it came before the court. At the same time, Ginsburg did not answer questions about some potentially controversial issues. For instance, she affirmed her belief in the constitutional right of privacy and explained it at some length her personal judiciary philosophy and thoughts.
Regarding gender equality, Ginsburg was both forthright in discussing her views on topics about which she had previously written. The United States Senate converted her by a 96-3 vote on August 3, 1993. She received her commission on August 5, 1993, and took a jujitsu oath on August 10, 1993. Ginsburg was named later invoked during the confirmation process for Joan Roberts. Ginsburg was not the first nominee to avoid answering specific questions before Congress. And as a young attorney in 1981, Roberts had advised against Supreme Court nominees, giving them specific responses. Nevertheless, some conservative commentators and senators evoked the phrase Ginsburg president to defend his demeanors. In September 28, 2005, speech at the Wake Forest University, Ginsburg said Roberts' refusal to answer questions during the Senate confirmation hearings on the same cases went unquestionably right. Supreme Court tenure. Ginsburg characterized his performance on the court as a cautious approach to adjudication. She argued in a speech shortly before her nomination in the court that Measure's motion seemed to be right in the main for the constitutional as well as common law adjudication. Doctoral limbs too swiftly shaped, experienced teachers may prove unstable. Legal scholar Case Stumpstein characterized Ginsburg as a rational minimalist, a jurist who seeks to build cautiously on precedent rather than pushing the Constitution towards our own vision. The retirement of Justice Chandra Day on Kanya in 2006 left Ginsburg as the only woman on the court. Lita Greenhouse on the New York Times referred to the subsequent 2006 to 2007 term of the court as the time where Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg found her voice and used it. The term also marks the first time in Ginsburg's history with the court where she read multiple dissents from the bench, attacked an employee to single more intense disagreement with the majority. With the retirement of Justice Charles Paul Stevens, Ginsburg became the senior member of what was sometimes referred as to the court's liberal wing. When the court spit fire for along ideological lines with the liberal justices were mainly in the minority, Ginsburg often had the authority to assign authorship of the dissenting opinion because of his seniority. Ginsburg was a proponent of the liberal dissenters speaking with one voice and where practicable, presenting a unified approach to which all the dissenting justices can agree. During Ginsburg's entire Supreme Court tenure from 1993 to 2020, she only hired one African-American clerk, Paul J. Wofford. During her 13 years on the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, she never hired an African-American clerk, intern, or secretary. The lack of diversity was briefly as an issue during her 1993 confirmation hearing. When this issue was raised by Senate Judiciary Committee, Ginsburg said, "If you confirm me for this job, my attractiveness to black candidates is going to improve." This issue received renewed attention after more than 100 of her former legal clerks served as pallbearers during her funeral. Gender discrimination. Ginsburg offered the court's opinion in United States v. Virginia, which struck down the Virginia Military Institute male-only admissions policy as violating the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. For Ginsburg, the state actor could not use gender to deny women equal protection, therefore VMI must allow women for the opportunity to attend VMI with its unique educational methods. Ginsburg emphasized that the government must show an excessively passive justification to use a classification based on sex. VMI proposed a separate institute for women, but Ginsburg found this solution reminiscent of the effort by Texas decades earlier to prevent the University of Texas Law School for Whites by establishing a separate school for blacks. Ginsburg dissented in the court's decision on Lebreter on Goyer 55, a case where plaintiff Liddy Lebreter filed a lawsuit against employer claiming pay discrimination based on her gender under the Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. In a 5-4 decision, the majority interpreted the statute of limitations as starting to run at the time of every pay period, even if a woman did not know that she was being paid less than her male colleagues until later. Ginsburg found the result absurd, pointing out that the women often do not know they being paid less, and therefore it was unfair to expect them to act in that time of each paycheck. She also called attention to the reluctance women may have in male-dominated fields to making waves by filing lawsuits over small accounts, choosing instead to wait for the disparity accumulates. As part of her dissent, Ginsburg called the Congress to amend Title VII to undo the court's decision with legislation following the election of President Barack Obama in 2008. The Liddy Lebreter Failed Pay Act, making it easier for employees to win pay discrimination claims, became law. Ginsburg was created with helping to inspire the law. Abortion rights. Ginsburg discussed her views on abortion and gender equality in the 2009 New York Times interview, which said, "The basic thing is that the government has no business making that choice for a woman." Although Ginsburg consistently supported abortion rights and joined in the court's opinion striking down Nebraska's partial abortion law in Steinberg versus on the 40th anniversary of the court Roe versus Wade, she criticized the decision as Roe terminating an ancient Democrat movement to liberalize abortion laws, which have built a more durable conscience in support of abortion rights. Ginsburg was minority for Gonzalez v. Carnhart, a 5-4 decision upholding restrictions on partial birth abortion. In addition, Ginsburg opposed the majority's decision to defer legislative findings that her procedure was not safe for women. Ginsburg focused on ire on the way Congress reached in findings and the veracity of the findings, joining the majority for Whole Woman's Health v. Hartstead, a case which struck down parts of 2013 Texas law regarding abortion providers. Ginsburg also authorized a short concerning opinions, which was even more critical of the legislation at issue. She asserted the legislation was not aimed at protecting women's health, as Texas has said, but rather to impede women's access to abortions. Although Ginsburg did not author the majority opinion, she was credited by influencing her colleagues on the case Stafford Unified School District of Reading. The court had ruled that a school went too far in ordering a 13-year-old female student to strip to her bra and underpants so female officials can search for drugs. In an interview published prior to the court's decision, Ginsburg shared her view that some of her colleagues did not fully appreciate the effect of a strip search on a 13-year-old girl, as she said. "They have never been a 13-year-old girl." In the 8-1 decision, the court agreed that the school search went too far and violated the Fourth Amendment and allowed the student's lawsuit against the school to go forward. Only Ginsburg and Stevens would have allowed the student to sue individual school officials as well. The Heron v. United States. Ginsburg dissented from the court's decision not to suppress evidence due to a police officer's failure to update a computer system. In contrast to Roberts' emphasis on the suppression as a means to deter police misconduct, Ginsburg took a more robust view on the use of suppression as a remedy for a violation of a defendant's Fourth Amendment rights. Ginsburg views suppression as a way to prevent the government from profiting from mistakes, and therefore as a remedy to prefer justice, integrity, and respect civil rights. She also rejected Roberts' assertion that suppression would not deter mistakes. Contending making police pay a high price for mistakes will encourage them to take greater care. International law. Ginsburg advocated the use of foreign law and norms to take shape U.S. law and judicial options, a view rejected by some of her conservative colleagues. Ginsburg supported using foreign interpretation of the law for persuasive value and possible wisdom, not as a precedent which the court is bound to follow.
Ginsburg expressed the view that consulting international law is a well-ingrained tradition in American law, counting John Henry Wigmore and President John Adams as internationalists. Ginsburg all reliance on international law dated back to her time as an attorney. In the first argument before the court, Reed v. Reed, she cited two German cases. In her concurring opinion, Greta v. Bollinger, a decision upholding Michigan Law School's affirmative action admissions policy, Ginsburg noted that there was a accord between the notion that affirmative action and admission policies would have an endpoint and agrees with international treaties designed to combat racial and gender discrimination. Voting rights and affirmative action. In 2013, Ginsburg dissented to Shelby County v. Holder, in which the court held unconstitutional part of the voting rights of 1965, requiring federal preclearance before the change in voting practices. Ginsburg wrote, "Throwing out the preclearance what has worked and has continued to work to stop discriminatory changes is like throwing away your umbrella in a rainstorm because you're not getting wet." Besides Grutter, Ginsburg wrote in favor of affirmative action in a dissent against Grants v. Bollinger, in which the court ruled an affirmative action policy unconstitutional because it was not narrowly tailored to the state's interests in diversity. She argued that the government decision makers may properly distinguish between policies and executive and inclusion. Actions designed to burden groups long designed to full citizenship statutes and not sensibly rape with measures taken to hasten the day with entrenched discrimination and its after effects have not been expliterated. Native Americans. In 1997, George Ginsburg wrote the majority opinion in State v. A1 Contractors against tribal jurisdiction and tribal owned land in the reservation. The case involved a non-member who caused a crash in the Mandan-Heston Aleut Nation. Ginsburg reasoned that the state right-of-way on which the crash occurred rendered the tribal-owned land equivalent to non-Indian land. She then considered the rule of set in Montana v. United States, which allowed tribes to regulate the activities of non-members who have a relationship with the tribe. Ginsburg noted that the tribe's employer did not have a relationship with the tribe, but she reasoned that the tribe could not regulate their activities because the victim had no relationship to the tribe. Ginsburg concluded that those who drive carelessly on a public highway running through a reservation danger all in the facility and surely jeopardize the safety of tribal members. Having a non-member go before an unfamiliar court was not crucial to the political integrity, the economic security, or the welfare of the three affiliated tribes. The decision by unanimous court was generally criticized by the scholars of Indian law, such as David Gretches and Frank Promisium. Later, in 2005, Ginsburg cited the Doctrine and Discovery in the majority opinion of Silvestre and Oneida Indian Nation of New York, and concluded that the Oneida Indian Nation would not live its ancient sovereignty, revive its ancient sovereignty over its historic land. The Discovery Doctrine has been used to grant ownership of Native American land to colonial governments. The Oneida had lived in towns, grew a sense of crops, and maintained trade routes to the Gulf of Mexico. In her opinion for the court, Ginsburg reasoned that the historic Oneida land had been converted from wilderness ever since it had been dislodged for the Oneida's possession. She also reasoned that the long-standing, distinctly non-Indian character of the area of its inhabitants and regulatory authority consistently exercised by New York State, its counties and towns, justifies the ruling. Ginsburg also invoked sua sponte, the doctrine of lashes, reasoning that the Oneidas took a long delay in seeking judicial relief. She also reasoned that the dispossession of the Oneidas land was ancient. Lower courts later relied on Shemo as president to extinguish Native American land claims, notably in Cayuga Indian Nation of New York v. Pataki. Ginsburg regretting her decision in Shamal more than any other decision she made in the court. Damn. She prevented Native Americans in the state of New York, the Oneida Nation and the Cayuga Nation in the state of New York, wow, to getting land that was owned to them. Okay. Less than a year, Shiro Ginsburg offers a starkly contrasting approach to Native American law. In December 2005, Ginsburg dissented in Wagon v. Perry Band Potawatomi Nation, arguing that a state tax on fuel sold to Potawatomi retailers would appreciably nullify the Perry Band Potawatomi Nation's own tax authority. In 2008, when Ginsburg, President Instrat, was used in Plains Commerce for long family land and cattle co, she dissented and argued that the tribal court of the Chenier River Lakota Nation has jurisdiction over the case. Ginsburg suggested that the next justice should be U.S. District Court Judge Dwayne Hamata, who's a enrolled member of the Hopi tribe. In 2020, Ginsburg joined the ruling of McGirt v. Oklahoma, which affirmed Native American jurisdictions over reservations in much of Oklahoma. Other notable majority opinions. In 1999, Ginsburg wrote the majority opinion in Olmstead v. LC, in which you ruled that mental illness is a form of disability, covered under the Americans with Disability Act of 1990. Ginsburg wrote the majority opinion in Friends of the Earth, Landlord Environmental Services, in which the court held residents had standing to seek fines for an industrial polluter that affected their interests and that is able to continue doing so. Other activities. Yeah. I'm going to take a quick break. I'm going to give myself something to drink real quick. Stand by. Hold on for a second. This is Black Wall Street Chronicles, and we're back at it again. Yeah, so I had to take a break and get myself something to drink. So earlier, I found out that Justice Ginsburg has blocked Native Americans from getting land in the state of New York. which is interesting. So this Supreme Court justice is not as perfect as everybody says she is. Also found out that she has not given enough opportunities to black people. Because they criticize her for not having hiring black law clerks and black law assistants to work under her. So, let's talk about the other stuff that she did. Other notable majority opinions. In 1999, Ginsburg wrote the majority opinion in Olmstead v. LC, in which the court had ruled that mental illness is a form of disability covered under the Americans with Disabilities Act of 1990. In 2000, Ginsburg wrote the majority opinion in Friends for the Earth v. Latvia Environmental Services, in which the court held that residents have a standing to seek fines for an industrial polluter that affects the interest and that is able to continue doing so. At a request, Ginsburg rendered the offer office to Vice President Al Gore for a second term during the second inauguration of Bill Clinton on January 12, 1997. She was the third woman to administer an inaugural offer office. Ginsburg is believed to have been the first Supreme Court justice to officiate at a same-sex wedding, performing the August 31st, 2013 ceremony for Kennedy Center presented Michael Kessler and Rob Roberts, a government economist. Earlier that summer, the court had bolstered same-sex marriage rights in two separate cases. Ginsburg believed the issue being settling her officiate if there was no longer the fear of compromising rulings on the issue. The Supreme Court bar formally inscribed the certificates on the Year of Our Lord, which some unorthodox Jews opposed, and asked Ginsburg to object to. She did so due to her objection. Supreme Court bar members have been given other choices in how to inscribe the year on their certificates. Despite their ideological differences, Ginsburg considered Ertonian scholar for a closet colleague in the court. Closest colleague on the court. The Chief Justice often dined together and attended the opera. In addition to befriending modern composers, including Tobias Picker, her spare time, Ginsburg appeared in several operas in non-speaking supremacy roles, such as Die Fickermas and Anjou auf Naxos, and spoke lines penned by herself and the daughter of the regiment. In January 2012, Ginsburg went to Egypt for 4 days to discuss with judges, law school for Sicily, law school students, and legal experts. In an interview with Al Hadda TV, she said the first requirement of a new constitution should be that it would safeguard basic fundamental human rights like our First Amendment. Acts of Egypt should model its new constitution of those of other nations. She said Egypt should be aided by all constitutional writing that has gone on since the end of World War II, and cited that the United States Constitution and the Constitution of South Africa as documents she might look to if drafting a new constitution. She said that U.S. was fortunate to have a constitution authorized by very wise men, but said that in the 1780s, no woman was able to participate directly in the process, and slavery still existed in the U.S. That's correct. During three interviews in July 2016, Ginsburg criticized presumptive Republican president nominee Donald Trump, telling the New York Times and Associated Press that she did not think about the possibility of a Trump presidency. She joked that she might consider moving to New England. She later apologized for condemning the presented Republican nominee, calling her remarks ill-advised.
Ginsberg's first book, My Own Words, published by Simon & Schuster, was released on October 4, 2016. The book debuted in the New York Times bestseller list for hardcover notification in number 12. In Ginsberg's first book, My Own Words, published by Simon & Schuster, was released on October 4, 2016. The book debuted on the New York Times bestseller list for hardcover notification at number 12. While promoting her book in October 2016 during an interview with Katie Couric, Ginsberg responded to a question about Colin Kaepernick choosing not to stand for the national anthem in sporting events by calling the protest really dumb. She later apologized for her criticism, calling her earlier comment inappropriate, dismissive, and harsh, and nothing she hadn't not been familiar with the incident and should have been declined to respond with the question. In 2018, Ginsberg expressed her cause for the Me Too movement, which encourages women to speak up about their experience with sexual harassment. She told an audience, "It's about time. For long, women have been silent, thinking there was nothing you could do about it. But the law is on the side of women or men who has encountered harassment, and that's a good thing." She also reflected on her own experience with gender discrimination and sexual harassment, including a time when a chemistry professor, Colina, attempted to trade her exam's answers for sex. This is her personal life. A few days after Bader graduating from now, she married Martin D. Ginsberg, who later became an internationally prominent tax attorney practicing at Well, Gushen & Monges. Upon her ascension to the D.C. Circuit, the couple moved from New York City to Washington, D.C., where her husband became a professor of law at Georgetown University Law Center. Their daughter, Jane C. Ginsberg, is a professor at Columbia Law School. Their son, James Stephen Ginsberg, is the founder and president of Silver Records, a classical music recording company based in Chicago, Illinois. Ginsberg was a grandmother of four. After the birth of their daughter, Ginsberg was diagnosed with testicle cancer. During this period, Ginsberg attended classes and took notes of both of them, typing her husband dedicated papers and caring for their daughter for their sick husband. During this period, she also made the Harvard Law Review. They celebrated their 56th wedding anniversary on June 23, 2010. Martin Ginsberg died of complications from metastatic cancer on June 27, 2010. They spoke publicly on being in a shared parenting marriage, including the speech Martin Ginsberg wrote and had intended to give long before his death that Ruth Bader Ginsberg delivered posthumously. Ginsberg was a non-observant Jewish. In March 2015, Ginsberg and Rabbi Lauren Hismud relayed an essay titled "The Historic and Visionary Women of Passover," an essay highlighting the roles of five key women in the saga. The text states, "These women had a vision leading out the darkness shrouding their world. They were women of action, prepared to defy authority to make their vision a reality bathed in the light of day." In addition, she decorated her chambers with an artist's rendering of the Hebrew phrase from Deuteronomy, "Tzedek, tzedek, tirof," "Justice, justice, shall you pursue," as a reminder of her heritage and professional responsibility. Ginsberg had a collection of lace jabets from around the world. She said in 2014 she had particular and jabets she wore with them in suiting descents, back gold embroidery and festive stones, as well as another she wrote issuing majority opinions, which was a gift from Lawkers. Her favorite jabot, woman with white beads, was from Cape Town, South Africa. In 1999, Ginsberg was diagnosed with colon cancer, the first of her five bouts with cancer. She underwent surgery followed by chemotherapy and radiation therapy. During the process, she did not miss a day in the bench. Ginsberg was physically weakened by the cancer treatment, and she began working with a personal trainer, Brian Johnson, and a former Army reservist attached to U.S. Army Special Forces.
Train Ginsburg twice weekly and Justice Only Gym at the Supreme Court. Ginsburg saw her physical fitness improve after her first bout with cancer. She was able to complete 20 push-ups in a session before her 80th birthday. Nearly a decade about after her first bout with cancer, Ginsburg again went surgery on February 5, 2009, this time for pancreatic cancer. Ginsburg had a tumor which was discovered in an early stage. She was released from a New York City hospital on February 13, 2009, and returned to the bench when the Supreme Court went back into session on February 23, 2009. After experiencing discomfort while exercising in the Supreme Court gym in November 2014, she had a silent place in the right coronary artery. Ginsburg's next hospitalization helped her detect another round of cancer. On November 8, 2018, Ginsburg fell in her office at the Supreme Court, fracturing three ribs, where she was hospitalized. An outpouring of public support followed. Although the day after her fall, Ginsburg's nephew revealed she had already returned to official judicial work after the day of observation. A CT scan of ribs following her November 8 fall showed cancerous nodules in her lungs. On December 21st, Ginsburg underwent a left lung lobectomy at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center to remove the nodules. For the first time since joining the court more than 25 years later, Ginsburg missed an oral argument January 7, 2019. While she recuperated, she returned to the Supreme Court on February 5, 2019 to participate in a private conference with other justices in her first appearance and at the court since her cancer surgery in December 2018. Months later, in August 2019, the Supreme Court announced that Ginsburg had recently completed 3 weeks of focused radiation treatment to a tumor found in her pancreas over the summer. By January 2020, Ginsburg was cancer-free. By February 2020, the cancer had returned, but the news was not released to the public. However, by May 2020, Ginsburg was once receiving treatment for a recurrence of cancer. She regulated her position that she would remain a member of the court as long as I could do the job full steam, adding that she remained fully available to do so. When John Paul Stevens retired in 2020, Ginsburg became the oldest justice on the court at age 77. Despite rumors that she would retire because of advanced age, poor health, and death of her husband, she denied that she was planning to step down. In an interview in August 2010, Ginsburg said her work on the court was helping her, quote, with the death of her husband. She also expressed a wish to emulate Justice Lewis' service of nearly 23 years. Which she achieved in April 2016. She stated that she had a new model to emulate in the former colleague Justice John Paul Stevens, who retired at age 90 after nearly 35 years on the bench. During the presidency of Barack Obama, some progressive attorneys and activists called for Ginsburg to retire so that Obama could appoint a like-minded successor, partially while she Democratic held control of the U.S. Senate. They mentioned Ginsburg's age and past health issues as factors making her longevity uncertain. Ginsburg rejected these pleas. She affirmed her wish to remain as justice as long as she was mentally sharp enough to perform her duties. Some believed that it would lead up to the 2016 presidential election. She was waiting for candidate Hillary Clinton to beat Donald Trump before retiring, so Clinton would be to nominate an even more liberal justice. Moreover, Ginsburg's opinion the political climate would prevent Obama from appointing a jurist like herself. At the time of her death in September 2020, Ginsburg was at age 87, the fourth oldest serving U.S. Supreme Court justice member in the history of the country. Talk about her death. And the death, Ginsburg died of complications of pancreatic cancer on September 18, 2020 at age 87. Ginsburg died on the eve of Rosh Hashanah, and according to Rabbi Richard Jacobs, one of the times when Rosh Hashanah suggests that very righteous people would die at the end of the year because they would need it until the very end. On the announcement of her death, thousands of the people gathered in the Supreme Court building to lay flowers, light candles, and leave messages. 5 days after her death, the 8th Supreme Court Justice, Ginsburg children, and other family members have a private ceremony for Ginsburg in the court's Great Hall. Following the private ceremony, Ginsburg casualties move outdoors to the public and pay respects. Thousands of the mourners lined up to walk past the casket over the course of 2 days. After the 2 days were exposed in the court, Ginsburg laid in the state at Capitol. She was the first woman and the first Jew to lie state therein. On September 29th, Ginsburg was buried beside her husband in Arlington National Cemetery. Ginsburg's death opened a vacancy on the Supreme Court about 6 weeks before the 2020 presidential election, initiating controversies regarding the nomination and confirmation of her successor. Days before her death, Ginsburg dictated a statement to her grandfather, Solara Spira, as heard by Ginsburg, doctor, and others in the room at the time. "My most fervent wish is that I would not be replaced until a new president is installed." In the hours following the news of her death, more than $20 million was donated to various Democratic politicians via Act Blue, more than quintupled the previous record amount. Around $80 million was donated through Act Blue within 24 hours of her death. Yeah, so that's the life of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. I've learned a couple of new things when reading from Wikipedia.com. I learned that this Supreme Court justice, even though she was a great advocate for LGBTQ and gender politics issues, she prevented Native Americans from receiving the land in the state of New York. She also was against black athletes like Colin Kaepernick doing the peaceful protest. And also, President Obama administration wanted her to step down because they knew about her failing health complications. And she wanted to hold off until Hillary Clinton was in office, which was a bad move because President Trump was meant to be elected. President Trump is elected now, and now President Trump is going to replace her. And President Barack Obama and the Democratic Party warned her that this was going to happen. But I don't know. And what I also find very interesting is that she did not have too many black people working under her. She did not give a lot of black people opportunities. So that's also very interesting. So the rumors about her, you know, being a bigot, allegedly being a bigot, it may be true. I don't know. And I basically found out, like I said earlier, that she prevented Native Americans from receiving land in the state of New York. So, I don't know. Now, these white millennials are saying that she's the notorious RBG and they're trying to make her a pop cultural icon. I don't think that she really was that great. I mean, she did do great things, but I don't really think that she was this perfect, you know, angel that the, you know, these white millennial liberals is basically say that she is. And the fact that she did not step down during the Obama administration was kind of weird. I don't know. Yeah, so what I'm gonna do is I'm going to read a couple of more articles about Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Give me a second. I'm looking at it and I'm basically finding no articles. Ginsburg makes controversial racist comments on Roe versus Wade. Okay. This is a Baptist Press, this article. Yeah, she did a controversial statements on Roe versus Wade, so we're gonna read about that. Washington Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg is under criticism for seemingly saying in a new interview she thought was the initial purpose of Roe versus Wade was to rid the country of those we did not want to have many of. Ginsburg made the comments in an interview that she will be in the weekend's New York Times magazine, but that's not is already posted online. She was referencing not only Roe, but the 1980s Harris v. McCreary's decision in a 5-4 ruling that upheld the Hyde Amendment, which she prevents Medicaid from funding abortion. Ginsburg made clear that the interview that she favors federal money financing abortions for the poor. The controversial section of the interview began when she is asked, "If you were a lawyer again, what would you accomplish to ac what would you want to accomplish as a future feminist legal agenda?" "Reproductive choice has to be straightened out," Ginsburg responded. "There will never be a woman of means without choice anymore. That just seems to be so obvious. The states that have changed their abortion laws before Roe to make abortion legal are not going to change back. So we have a policy that affects only poor women, and it can never be otherwise. I don't know why this hasn't been said more often." The reporter then asked for a follow-up. "Are you talking about the distances women have to travel because in parts of the country, abortion isn't essentially available? There are so few doctors and clinics that do the procedure, and also the lack of Medicaid for the abortions for poor women." "Yes," said the ruling Harris v. McCreary, "that has surprised me. Frankly, I thought that the time Roe was decided, there was a concern about population growth and particularly growth in populations where we did not want too many of. So that Roe was going to be set up for Medicaid funding for abortion, which some people felt would risk coercing women into having abortions which they didn't really want them. But when the court decided McCreary, the case came out the other way. Then I realized that my perception of it has been altogether wrong." Ginsburg's comments set off a lively discussion in the blogosphere, with many wondering, did she really mean that? So Ginsburg thought the court wanted a method in eugenics that the government could use to reduce the population growth of certain populations that we didn't want expanding. No wonder she has occasionally admitted that Roe was a bad decision, and Morrison wrote in the hot air conservative blog. Another conservative blogger, Scott Old at Towns Al Cole, said that he would grant the possibility that she may have been stating that this ironically and tongue-in-cheek, that she did not support what she thought was Roe's intent. But he also wonders that about Ginsburg's legal thoughts between the 1973 Roe decision and the 1980s Harris ruling, where she worked at Columbia Law School and for the American Civil Liberties Union. It's startling to consider that the practicing liberal feminist attorney could labor for 7 years under the misconception that the Supreme Court rulings is in part an expression of judicially sanctioned racial discrimination. Alt wrote, "One would think that Ms. Ginsburg and her colleagues would have taken to the streets in the defense of a poor minority woman whose wounds has suddenly become the chambers of ethnic cleansing. They did not protest." In an interview, Ginsburg said she's not a big fan of restrictions on abortion, such as mandatory waiting periods. Michael. All right, so that was an article of the Baptist Press. It's a conservative Christian article. The author who wrote this article is Michael Frost, if you want to look at it. Baptistpress.com. Ginsburg made controversial statements on Roe versus Wade. It was published in July 9th, 2009. This is This is an article for Quartz Magazine, QZ.com. When was it published? It was published. October 13, 2016. This article is more than 2 years old. It's by Nora Bolarski. Mr. Noah, I hope I'm not pronouncing your name wrong. If I am, I'm sorry. It's dumb and disrespectful, U.S. Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg said recently about the Colin Kaepernick's refusal to stand during the national anthem. Speaking with journalist Katie Couric, Ginsburg added, I would have the same answer if you asked me about flag burning. I think it's a terrible thing to do. Many fans of the venerable liberal jurist have taken aback by Ginsburg's comments. Ginsburg has been a champion of women's rights such as racial justice issues. Yeah, sure she has. She penned a nobly impassioned dissent on the court majority gutted the Voting Rights Act in 2013, and she's been a strong proponent of the constitutionality of affirmative action programs in higher education. Based on her stances in the court, you would think she would have some sympathy for an entirely nonviolent, even reverent effort to protest against the rampant racism of the justice system. Excuse me, phone is ringing. Sorry about that interruption. My phone was ringing. People don't know that I'm freaking recording. I hate this quarantine. I gotta be in the house and not the studio. Anyway. Where was I? Many of the venerable liberal jurists have been taken aback by Ginsburg's comments. Ginsburg has been a champion of women's rights as racial justice issues. She penned a nobly impassioned dissent after a court majority gutted the Voters' Rights Act in 2013, and she has been a strong proponent of the constitutionality of affirmative action programs in higher education. Based on her stances on the court, you would think that she has some sympathy for entirely nonviolent, irrelevant effort to protest against the rampant racism of the justice system. But after reading Ginsburg's new collection of writings, My Own Words, her statements are a bit less surprising, from her 1946 eighth grade essay on the virtues of the United Nations, right through her 2016 tribute to a good friend, deceased conservative justice Antonin Scalia. One overrunning truth emerges: Ginsburg is no radical. She's something of a liberal celebrity. Ginsburg's popularity has been helped along by proper the name. Now also a book that refers Ginsburg as a notorious RBG. The moniker, inspired by rapper Biggie Smalls, is funny because it's so encouraging. Ginsburg in real life isn't a gangster for justice. She's the embodiment of respectability politics. Thank you. Glad somebody says it. Over and over in the book, Ginsburg emphasizes the importance of moderation, respect, and incremental change. The court really does prize collegiately, she insists. She is proud of her close friendship with Scalia, a man who was ever his virtues in person was an open and determined bigot on the bench. She approvingly quotes former Justice Louis Brothers' dictum, "It is more important for the actual rule of law to be settled than it is to be settled right." This is a model that prioritizes stability over justice and encourages the senators on the bench to sign a majority opinions in all but most extreme cases. Ginsburg even reiterates the conservative shove-off that Roe v. Wade moved too far too fast. Measure motions seem to rewrite, in the main for constitutional as well as common law adjudications. She cautions, doctrinal limbs too swiftly shape. Spurious teachers may prove unstable. In other words, go slow, be careful, don't offend shallow objections, and trust the system to get things done. Eventually, Ginsburg believes that the government works, but if you let it which is way, presumably she finds showing disrespect for the national anthem so distasteful.
Doing typical move towards compromise, she ensures protesters that she does not want to put them in jail. Ginsburg, in short, in the solid center left, whom the within this system, liberal. That doesn't make her a bad judge, nor does not take it away for her legal legacy. And indeed, while Solis left, center left, working within the system, white women liberals have gotten a certain amount of flack this election season. Ginsburg's career makes perhaps the strongest possible case for their virtues. Her incremental strategic flatter to opposition approach has helped push her through substantial advances over the course of her jiu-jitsu career. To reveal, in 1970, she took on the case of Charles E. Moritz, an editor who was denied a tax deduction for caring for his mother, because her suggestions were reserved for women. Fighting for male rights enabled her to establish a precedent against gender discrimination, which in turn ended up benefiting many women. Her even-handed collegial approach also got her into high court. In the book, Ginsburg fondly recalls that when Bill Clinton Escalator, who is most likely to serve with Ginsburg's name, was one that the conservative jurist suggested first. But if Ginsburg's career is a blueprint for liberal establishment, her comments about Kaepernick are a reminder that the love for the system can have its own downsides. Collegiate can come slide into a belief that your friends in power have more of a right, consideration, and kindness than outsiders who raise their voices, because they rightfully fear that you will not hear them otherwise. Ginsburg's assertion that Kaepernick ruled as disrespect also echoes the usual center-left PC panic, in which the suggestion that professors might warn students about sensitive content is treated as an assault on fundamental freedoms. The center-lefters also believe that free speech acts of college protests, cited positions, or canceling plays are actually terrified of the speech itself. As a nonviolent protester named Martin Luther King Jr. once said, "You deplore demonstration taking place in Birmingham, but your statement, I am sorry to say, fails to express a similar concern for the conditions that brought about the demonstrations. I am sure that none of you would want to rest content with the superficial kind of social analysis that deals with the effects and does not grapple with underlying causes. Shouldn't a Supreme Court judge be more worried about a judicial system that murders black people with impunity than with the privileged sight of kneeling when a song is played?" Ginsburg has certainly shown that she is worried about the racism in the jiu-jitsu system. She is more comfortable addressing it through established, respectful channels. Those channels can be effective, and anyone who cares about social justice has to be thankful that Ginsburg is so adept at using them. But the establishment liberals like Ginsburg should be willing to acknowledge that the limits of their incrementalism and support folks who protest sometimes in collegial ways precisely because they have no access to the chambers of power. Well said. This is a great article by Mr. Noor Berlowski. Quartz, QZ.com. Yeah, you can go check it out. Yeah, that's basically the point of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Everybody thinks that she's this radical, you know, liberal edgelord, but in actuality, she is, actually, she's not progressive at all, and she is friends with that Mr. Scalia, that's his name, that racist guy, alleged racist guy on the bench, so I don't know. So, I'm gonna consider this an end to this podcast. Yeah, I just don't like the narrative, even though Ruth Bader Ginsburg has done for LGBTQ issues, and she has helped gender politics issues. May she rest in peace. But she has not been progressive when it comes to Native American land rights and race issues within the African American community. And in closing, thank you very much for listening to this podcast. Be blessed, and take care. Bye-bye.